Welcome, listeners. We are again presenting an episode of WOB Radio, and that WOB means Wobblies, and the Wobblies is a nickname for the IWW, which is Industrial Workers of the World, one of the earliest unions that's very inclusive. It was one of the first ones that was inclusive to women and Native Americans and other people of color. It's very open, and it's still that way today, and we're growing. So if you're interested in that, contact us through Facebook, or Marilyn will give you more information. So my name is Lynn. I'm a retired social worker and medical interpreter.
My name is Marilyn. I go by she, they. I'm a retired mental health worker, and I've been a Wobbly since before 2008.
My name is Pete. I was a longshoreman, and I joined the WOBs in the mid to late 90s, and yeah.
I'm Danielle. I'm just a disabled worker, and I'm here with the WOBs.
Greetings. My name is Gordon. I use he, him pronouns. A retired shipyard worker, and I live in Bremerton, and I've been a member of the Tacoma branch since 2008.
My name is Eric. I've been with the WOBs since August of last year. I'm a co-producer on the radio show, and happy to be here.
And my name is Noah. I happen to be the branch secretary for the Tacoma IWW. I've been a member since March of 2021, and ever since then, I've been working hard to organize with my fellow workers in the union and keep the ball rolling for the IWW. Our song today is going to be Dump the Bosses Off Your Back. It's one of our old IWW classics from way back in our heyday in the early 1900s, and it's one of our very popular fight songs that's still sung in union halls to this day.
Are you poor, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all patched and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack? Fool, why don't you buck like thunder? And dump the bosses off your back. All the agonies you suffer, you can end with one good whack. Stiffen up, you ornery duffer, and dump the bosses off your back.
And fellow worker Marilyn, would you go ahead and read off the preamble?
I will do that. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class has interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed, and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, quote, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. Amen.
Thank you, Marilyn. And I'd just like to read off a brief land recognition here before we get into today's content. We would like to remind our viewers that our union members, as well as this show, is produced and resides on the lands of the Puyallup people, and we are forever grateful for the ability and the opportunity to reside on these lands. We recognize and stand in solidarity with the Puyallup tribe's pursuit to reclaim their lands and to have full autonomy over their affairs. Let's go ahead and jump right into labor news. I also wanted to give a brief update on the two incarcerated unionists who are currently being held down at the Northwest Detention Center. As many of you know, there are two union members currently detained. Lalo Juarez, who was an organizer with Familias Unidas por la Justicia, and had also been a community organizer as well. And the other one was Llewellyn Dixon, who worked up at UW Medicine. She was an SEIU 925 member. They are still being currently held at the Northwest Detention Center, which is operated by Geo Group, a private prison company that works in close collaboration with immigration enforcement. There have been multiple rallies and demonstrations, as well as legal aid in order to try and get them freed from immigration detention at the moment. It was actually one of the big speaking points to my memory at the recent May Day protests that we had down here in Tacoma. So there are still a couple of opportunities for fellow listeners and fellow workers as well to get involved to help free them. One of them is through, so C2C is a community-based organization.
It stands for Community to Community.
Thank you. They actually published an update recently. Whatcom and Skagit County residents are watching ICE and Border Patrol after multiple first-hand reports that ICE is taking people on their way to work and at their workplaces. It is clear that the assault on workers is underway. You can join the Washington State Labor Council in a mass solidarity action. That was back on March 27th. We actually attended that. If you want to help folks in Whatcom and Skagit County keep an eye on ICE activities, you can call or text the number 360-961-2802. And to help watch for ICE and Border Patrol activities in those areas. That's 360-961-2802 if you see any ICE or Border Patrol agents in the Whatcom or Skagit County areas. There's also a donation link on the Community to Community website. That's at foodjustice.org. If you go to their donation tab on their website, you can actually donate to Lalo Juarez's defense fund, which is going to be critically important for his immigration hearings coming up. There's also a petition currently being sent out through SEIU 925, where you can ask the UW Board of Regents, I believe it is, to demand that they do a better job protecting their organized workers from ICE and Border Patrol raids. And you can find that at the SEIU 925 website as well.
The last I heard, UW is forcing Llewellyn to use her vacation time while she's being incarcerated. You can certainly contact UW School of Medicine and tell them to cut that crap out.
Yes. It's incredibly unfair, and the union has also been, SEIU 925 has also been demanding that the UW Medicine be doing the same, because she should not be having to use vacation time while in an immigration detention center awaiting trial.
Against her will.
Against her will. Go ahead, Lynn.
What are the specific charges, and also, are those two people undocumented? Why were they picked up, basically?
Llewellyn had her green card.
Llewellyn Dixon of SEIU 925, she did have an active green card. I believe the excuse for her detainment was the fact that she had committed a crime the previous time that she was in the United States, but I think she was only charged a fine for it. I think it was some kind of financial mismanagement by accident, but they still charged her for it anyway. As for Lalo Juarez, I don't know his personal immigration status.
From what I heard, is his he came over to America as a kid. I don't know if he has a green card or not.
Right. According to a couple of articles I've read from labor-based sources, Lalo Juarez has been here since I believe he was 12 or 14.
Yeah.
So he's lived here a considerable amount of his life. I believe he's in his late 20s now. Yeah, essentially ICE and Border Patrol are going after people who so much as slightly slip up on any kind of immigration regulation in this country, which is only becoming even more stringent and more surveillance-based during the Trump administration. This is from Northwest Public Broadcasting. This was published by Lauren Gallup on April 23rd, 2025. Joining a growing trend, physicians at Marybridge Children's Hospital in Tacoma are trying to unionize. One person who offered commentary to the article is Derek Tam, a pediatric emergency physician at the hospital. Quote, "We really want to be able to have a voice, have a seat at the table, and work with them, the hospital administration, and be a little bit more collaborative. And we think that this unionization effort is the best way to do that. the desire to unionize, Tam said, has been motivated by changes that have been made across the hospital. He says that staff feel those changes impact the quality of care that they can provide for patients. Quote, "We have tried to have a lot of dialogue with hospital administration, and it hasn't really gone anywhere, and it's been frustrating for us in the emergency department." According to a press release from the union, Northwest Medicine United, the union the doctors are seeking to join, there are 65 physicians that the union plans to include in the bargaining unit. Mary Bridge Children's Hospital obviously didn't agree to an interview, but did provide a statement which confirmed that the hospital had received the petition for union representation. This is pretty interesting because normally when we think of healthcare unions, we typically think of nurses or the environmental staff, basically the people who are responsible for taking care of the hospital, cleaning the rooms.
Not the so-called professionals.
Yeah, exactly. We think of doctors as being this kind of like white collar, typically not organized, or physicians in this case. Typically a little bit more white-collar, not usually included in unions. But this is one of those cases where, actually, no, these are really white, literally white-collar workers. They're physicians who are trying to organize at Mary Bridge Children's Hospital. So
this is
really
why
cool.
It's so much more effective to unionize an entire industry rather than particular trades.
Right.
You know, if the doctors joined in with the nurses and the environmental staff, they would get action. That would be solidarity.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Gordon.
Physicians are typically, have been considered of the professional class.
Right.
So you get doctors, lawyers, that type of thing, right? Well, increasingly, doctors and registered nurses and medical staff that have direct involvement with patients are being treated the same way factory workers are being treated.
That's right.
There's lack of staffing. There's a speed up. What's happening is that they're increasingly forming unions of their own, doctors' unions, because if... For instance, I go to Kaiser Permanente, and it's like a glorified battalion aid station, you know, which I accept the model, which is, you know, a clinic-type model. I'm fine with that. But when they're being, you know, pressured to work longer hours, harder, and they're not enjoying the protections of their profession, then I think it's appropriate that they form unions.
Yeah, and especially for these physicians, because they're, you know, not only working in a children's hospital, but many of them are also working in the emergency department of the children's hospital as well. So as you can imagine, it's high stress. It's a high stress environment that's incredibly demanding. And of course, you know, children can be difficult patients to work with. Speaking as a child who's been a patient at a hospital before on multiple different occasions, you know, these are people who have really busted their butts in order to provide the best care that they can, and they want to make sure that they have a union that can better represent better compensation and better treatment for their work. And yeah, no, I think that's really cool. And, you know, I really like what you said, Marilyn. You know, if the doctors and the nurses and the environmental staff, and in this case, the physicians, all banded together in one union, they would have a lot more collective solidarity. If these people were to go on strike... The article says that they're filing for an NLRB election. If for whatever reason they were going to go on strike, the nurses and the environmental staff can't do anything about it because they're locked in by their contract. It creates a divide in the workplace.
So this leads me to wonder, you know, if the doctors are trying to unionize, what would happen if attorneys tried to unionize?
You know, that's actually pretty interesting because, and I know that this might be a little bit tangential, but I've talked to folks who have been part of other professional, quote-unquote, industries. People who, say, help lawyers as their staff or who work for, like, auditing or tax agencies, private agencies, things like that. And they typically think of themselves as kind of being above unionizing or somehow exempt from unionizing because they think, oh, I make too much money. Oh, I work in this very niche industry. Oh, I only have like 10 coworkers at best. And it's kind of interesting to have a conversation with those people that like, no, you still have collective labor rights if you want to exercise them. You can still do that regardless of what kind of industry that you're in. Of course, that's what at least we in the IWW have always believed.
I think part of what happens is that the employing class plays the divide and conquer game.
Mm-hmm.
And they throw these sops to the doctors and the attorneys. Oh, you're more important. You're above that.
Got a better parking spot.
Some people buy it.
Yeah.
But fewer people are buying it anymore.
The divide and conquer is a strategy that they know works. That's why they have everybody divided into groups with all aspects of life. Oh, you're this way, you're that way, you're this way. So that way we can't just come together and, you know, do what we need to do. So...
But we can.
But I'm saying this is the thing is, oh... All the dark-haired people here, all the light-haired people here, and so I'm talking hair colors, but like I'm talking about like, oh,
Any way they can.
Any way they can to divide us. Blue t-shirts, purple shirts.
I think it also has to do with a very capitalist frame of logic. That if you make a certain... if you make a certain amount of money, if you work in a particular industry, you're already getting treated well, or you're not the typical kind of worker that organizes, right? When we think of unions, we think of like dock workers or warehouse workers or nurses.
Steelmakers.
Yeah, exactly. You think of these very like, you know, hard hat, leather glove kind of industries, and not necessarily white medical coat, latex glove kind of industries.
Anybody can be, you too can become a malcontent.
There we go.
Not all of us is Marlon Brando and on the waterfront.
I will definitely keep our listeners in the loop as this develops. These physicians did not get voluntary recognition from the hospital, so they are looking forward to an NLRB election probably within the next 1 or 2 months, considering how long it takes to file and put together an NLRB election. Yes, fellow worker Eric?
How would they go about that?
Here's the thing, actually, and this is kind of an update from something that we've previously recorded on. There has to be a number of 3 people on the NLRB board in order for them to have a quorum and actually handle labor or election-related work. The woman who was fired by the Trump administration had to be forced to be rehired by a federal judge. So the NLRB is back together.
Oh, good.
The downside is that there's only 3 people doing it. So it's probably going to lead to a situation where grievances filed by employees or people who are trying to file for an election are going to have a lot harder time getting the NLRB to cooperate, just because they have been gutted, severely understaffed by the federal government. Okay. And not that it was doing great before, but now it's even weaker. Okay. So we have yet to see a case study where, at least to my knowledge, where the current staffing issue is going to get in the way. But it could be any day now, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. So it is a very tense moment for them, to say the least.
What was the name of the judge that was arrested for defending?
Dugan.
Dugan, thank you.
I will actually pull up that article right now.
She's from Milwaukee, right?
So this is our last brief little labor news article. And this is coming from AP News. So this was a Milwaukee judge, Hannah Dugan, who had been recently arrested for essentially trying to protect or defend someone who had immigration-related charges against them. This is a quote from the AP article. Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan is accused of escorting the particular individual with immigration charges and his lawyer out of her courtroom through the jury door last week. This article was published on April 26th. After learning that the immigration authorities were seeking his arrest, the man was taken into custody outside the courthouse after agents chased him on foot. Continuing on through the article, there have been multiple protests essentially outside of that court and at the local FBI building in that area as well, which is good. Keep up the pressure. There are no updates further on this case that I've been able to find, but she was essentially arrested for keeping someone from being detained by ICE because they were in a courtroom, and she let them out the back door because she didn't want them to get detained.
And part of how she saw her job is that as a judge, she is mandated to provide safe space for the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
If they were trying to arrest and detain him, while the judge was hearing the case, she was unable to provide that safety. So she felt duty-bound to not cooperate with the ICE people.
Right.
It might also be added that traditionally in the United States, in the court system, all the way from municipal court all the way up to the Supreme Court, they are an independent branch of government. They're co-equal
right.
with the other branches. And arresting somebody in that judge's court, to me, is not only an insult, but it insults the decorum of the court.
Right.
And as a sworn officer of the court, the judge decided that in the best interests of justice, not, you know, people trying to spin it like she was looking out for this guy and trying to treat him special. No, defendant should not be arrested inside a courtroom.
Yeah.
And because that insults the judge. They have a certain measure of sovereignty.
Absolutely. And you're both right that, I mean, this judge probably knows immigration law better than the people who are trying to detain the person she's trying to protect. I completely agree with Marilyn that she probably had really good reason to let this person out of the courtroom.
I think Gordon explained it way better than I did.
Mm-hmm. Tip my hat to you, Gordon.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
It's possible. It's probable.
Hello, I'm Danielle and with my partner Pete, we did some research on Centralia. Now, and we found the location of the Tacoma Hall. Now, we have this book from the 80s called The Wobbly War by John McLeland Jr. And in it, and we were just scrolling through the pages while going through the history of Centralia, of the Centralia tragedy. Now, we found that there was raids done in Tacoma in 1917, and we found the address to the old Tacoma Wobb Hall, which is 1314 Commerce Street. Now, what we also found interesting is we found in a newspaper article from around the time that has a list of the names on it. One of the names there is Adolf Ersen. Now, if you know your labor history, that name was is the name of a man who was at the Everett Massacre. So he was released in May. And a few months later, he's arrested in Tacoma. And they are forced to kiss the flag. They're beaten.
Beaten and forced to sing the Star-Spangled Banner. And their hall burned.
Yeah, and all the literature just thrown in the ground burned. Mm-hmm. And then he, Adolf Ersen, ends up getting deported back to, I believe it's Sweden. Mm-hmm. And so it's important that we found this. So this is an important part of Tacoma history that we have found linked to Everett and Centralia, too, because the huge wall.
Yeah, it's this whole circle of this person was at the Everett Massacre, but they were also the secretary for the Tacoma Hall that got raided shortly thereafter, and then later you said that they were a witness to Centralia, was
no,
it?
No, 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 the book is about Centralia.
Ah, okay, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah, the book is about Centralia, and it links these two things.
So for our fellow listeners, Pete and Danny did actually take me to the location where the old Wobb Hall is. So basically, where we visited, it's currently a parking lot, but there used to be older buildings that were there, and you can still see some of the brick facades sticking out of the sides of the embankment wall at the back. Gosh, what's that?
It's right next to the old spaghetti factory.
Yes, it's basically directly across the street from the old directly down the road from the old spaghetti factory.
Yeah, Commerce is a block from Pacific.
It's on Pacific Avenue, actually.
Oh,
yeah.
I thought you said
1314.
So if you're standing by the Bell Building, you know, Commerce. That one that was built in the 70s and mm-hmm. something, you see where the old Luzerne building was.
Uh-huh.
And so you walk down and you see these tiles on the ground. It's right there. And mm-hmm. this is where if you walk on Commerce. Now, if you walk around it, bit of a hike, into the parking lot, you'll see a little square on the side of up against the wall. And that, we believe, is where the hall used to be.
Yeah, all the Tacoma Wobblies were arrested and most of them deported. And three or four women were just held in prison for a couple of years.
Oh.
And then we don't know what happened to them. All the members just disappeared. And they burned the hall, burning all their newspapers and cards and everything in, what, 1917?
Yeah, 1917. Yeah.
Well, I know that there was another hall. It was the home of Ottilie Markle.
Mm.
And it's on South 15th Street. That was considerably later.
Lynn?
First they came for the journalists. After that, we don't know what happened.
Yeah, first they came for the unionists, and then suddenly there was no union activity anymore. But yeah, no, it was pretty interesting to visit because those two, you can see the tiles, but you can also see these two facades of the wall sticking out into this parking lot where there used to be the Luzon building. And so you can kind of get an idea of they were on Commerce Street, or at least what used to be Old Commerce Street before everything got redeveloped. And it's interesting to see that even just that part of the building is still there. Eric?
Now, is that in the same time frame as the Palmer Raids?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, 1917 would be shortly after the Everett Massacre. The Palmer Raids really didn't kick off until immediately after the end of the First World War in, like, early 1919.
Okay.
So that was when they kind of were like, oh, we're not going to take down the IWW locally. We're going to take down the IWW nationally.
1917, however, is the year that the United States entered World War I.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. So we are unsure. So we just need to try and get things together so we can have a plaque because it's important to remember this. Because also, because this is when we entered World War One, a lot of the Wobbs were opposed to World War One because how war treats its workers, and so that's another reason why they were beat. And so we need, in the connection to the Everett Massacre, we need to just, you know, try to figure out how to get a plaque there so that way we can keep this memory forever so that way it doesn't get destroyed and forgotten.
Yes.
That's right.
We're going to have our own historical site, damn it. Thank you so much for reporting on that. I'm definitely going to flip through that book. What was the name of it one more time? It was called Wobbly War, The Centralia Story, and it's by John McClelland Jr.
You guys have really researched.
Would we like to jump into the roundtable, fellow workers?
I think we should.
Alrighty. So our roundtable today is kind of a somewhat of a continuation of last time, but it's one that we're going to add to because it's definitely become much more pertinent now. This is about the ongoing attack against federal workforce unions by the Trump administration and Elon and his Doge cronies that are currently rifling through every federal department that they can, except for the federal departments where they're going to be getting money from, of course. They're going after the IRS. They're not exactly going after the Treasury just yet.
Or the Pentagon.
Or the Pentagon, yeah. So, Gordon, you had some personal experience and also some knowledge of being a federal employee. Would you like to divulge a little bit?
Sure. As introduction, my name is Gordon. I am a retired shipyard worker living in Bremerton, and I'm retired from Puget Sound Naval Shipyard, which is a federal facility. There used to be something like 12 or 14 federal shipyards. They've mostly been contracted out. So the federal government is down to 4 naval shipyards, which can handle auxiliaries and major combatants and submarines. I worked there for 31 years, and I was an outside machinist, meaning that I worked on the machinery aboard ship and also ripped it out and sent it to the shop and worked on it on the bench in the shop. And that is definitely part of the machinist union. And as soon as I hired in there, I asked to join the union, which immediately gave me I got the stink eye from a lot of the supervisors because they're just by DNA against unionism. And joining the union in a federal shipyard is an option. You don't have to. However, the unions are bound to represent you. If you get in trouble with management, they are bound by law to represent you, even if you don't pay any dues. We call them free riders for obvious reason. My point is that most people, if you say the word federal employee or government employee, they immediately get a picture in their mind of some guy behind a window with bars with a green eye shade and a stamp pad, and he's a bureaucrat. He sends you down to window 27. And so that image has been perpetrated by right-wing elements who want to treat with disdain and denigrate federal employees. And that's the picture they paint. They don't paint a picture of some guy humping a tool bag down 7 decks to fix a sea valve on an aircraft carrier. Nobody ever sees that in their head. Maybe they'll see a person working at NASA. But this is work, not to denigrate people who work in offices or who do that kind of work for a living. But that's what it is, and people don't understand that there are machinists, there are mechanics, there are electricians, there are guys working the flight line at Air Force bases, there are Department of the Army civilians that are fixing wheeled and tracked vehicles. Yeah, they're civilians, but they work directly for the Army and for the DOD. And a good thing about it is that you get a defined pension. Ooh, that's something that's an antique these days. But my experience is that to unionize in a federal shipyard like that, we're all under an umbrella organization called the Metal Trades Council. And that is a group of officers of all the different unions that are representing workers there. We were allowed to do this by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Okay, they wrote into the labor law that federal employees were allowed to organize. And of course, there are restrictions. The restrictions being, of course, that we couldn't go on strike, which actually kind of makes sense. But we got criticized by a lot of private enterprise machinists. I was in the IAM and AW. They would criticize us because we couldn't strike. We weren't a real union, is what they were trying to say. But let me tell you, I was a steward for a while, and I got some people out of trouble who were being railroaded, just like any other workplace. You know, they'll single people out who they don't like for whatever reason, and they'll make their lives a living hell. And if you haven't got a union, you haven't got anybody to back you up. So what I'm saying is that I did a lot of work like that as a steward, and they monitor that. There's only a certain amount of time you can spend in a day on union business. So I did a lot of extra. I stayed over and came in early and stuff to handle grievances and things like that. But get that picture out of your mind. Now, I know AFGE is the biggest employee union, and they're a good outfit. And AFSCME is a good outfit. These unions representing municipal, county, federal employees, state and federal employees are there for a reason. And the reason is to protect the workers and to make sure they're not harassed and to make sure that they get their overtime that's due. And that's another thing about working for the federal government. We had to follow every single safety rule, whereas in private enterprise, they look both ways. If nobody's there looking at you, you don't have to wear them safety glasses. You don't have to wear those earplugs. But we had to follow every safety rule. Get the picture out of your head of federal employees being nothing but bureaucrats. We were anything but bureaucrats. And we did actual production work aboard major capital ships. So if you want to fire federal employees, Don't start with the people who fix your nuclear submarines.
Yeah.
Okay, because whatever your views on war, I have very anti-war views, but part of that was developed because I worked for the shipyard and I understood what the machinery was doing. What I'm getting at is that this necessary work has to be done by workers who are highly skilled, trained, follow the safety regulations, follow the health regulations, and are there to protect your country. So if you listen to these Doge creeps, you're not gonna get a real picture of what a federal employee is. I just want the listeners to keep that in mind.
You know, a lot of these people are not exactly here to enforce the federal government's will. They're here to do a job. They're here to make a living, right, regardless of what industry they happen to work in for the federal government. We're talking about a huge pool of people. We're talking, I believe, off the top of my head, anywhere between 700,000 to close to 1 million people that directly work for the federal government and are unionized with unions working for the federal government. The fact that the feds are now going after federal union workers so hard is a massive attack to our country's infrastructure.
Yeah.
Because it's not just people working in the military. It's also people who are responsible for planning and repairing your roads.
Forest rangers.
Yeah, people who are responsible for maintaining your airports, yes, which is a concern of mine because I'm going to be flying here in a few months. If I don't show up on the radio show anymore, you know what happened.
I hope not.
And they're taking it. They've cut down the staff as air traffic controllers.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
what?
That's a page from Ronald Reagan's book. Because Ronald Reagan busted Patco, and I knew a guy in the shipyard who was a rigger, and when I got to know him, because we work with the riggers a lot, you know, they run the chain falls that lower our heavy machinery down into the hole, and so when I found out, you know, we got friendly, because I worked back shift, and, you know, we shoot the breeze and go out and have beer after the shift was over, and he told me he was an air traffic controller, and here he is packing a one-ton chain fall down into the engine room, when this guy was a highly skilled, you know, person that prevented you from crashing into another airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ronald Reagan, who was, in my opinion, kind of an idiot, didn't recognize the repercussions. He was just throwing a screw into the outfit. I'm just saying that Ronald Reagan busted the air traffic controllers, which was the precedent for what they're trying to do now.
I was in school at Green River Community College, living in Auburn, next door to the air traffic control school, when Ronald Reagan pulled the stunt. Pretty much 90% of the people living in my apartment complex were going to the air traffic control school.
Oh, my.
And it just took the bottom right out of them.
Mm-hmm.
They were training for this high-stress, high-paid job, and he just basically cut their careers short.
Well, you know who took over those jobs was air traffic controllers for the Navy, air traffic controllers for the Army and the Air Force, and they were just military personnel who happened to have this skill. And they were probably hoping, when I get out, I'm going to work for air traffic control.
And just to add a very quick note before I pass it on to Pete, those were people who couldn't say no.
That's right.
Those were people who, nobody in the military is allowed to unionize. I think that's pretty much clear.
Yeah.
But these were people, you know, 19 to 23-year-old kids who had gotten this training through the military and were basically told, you're going to go do this job or you're going to end up in a military prison. So they were also put in this really, really binding situation of, we have to act as scabs,
right,
even if they don't want to. Which I think is also important to highlight about.
But also in the military training, though, they kind of, I'm not knocking every military person, but as someone who's been through training, they kind of put the thing down to be a scab, at least in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, and Marine Corps. They really drive it home that, oh, you know, anything to the left of Ronald Reagan is bad, so you got to do what's good for the red, white, and blue. So.
Yeah.
Pete, what was
it? Yeah, I was going to say, as Karl Marx says, capitalism is its own grave digger. I think the long term here is that capitalism is trying to destroy itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to put all the work, it's going to replace all these federal government things with free market enterprises, right? And then when the money isn't there, the free market enterprises are going to disappear, and then there's not be anything for anyone. And I think that's the end goal, though.
And they're all going to bail out with nice golden parachutes once it all comes down.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, this whole federal worker situation is also becoming a lot more complicated because they're specifically going after not just the unionized people in the federal workforce, but also Doge, being headed by Elon Musk, is currently rifling through the Department of Labor as well, looking for any possible cuts that they can. And the Department of Labor, which basically exists to enforce workers' rights and also maintain the laws that make unions possible in this country on a legal basis, is an incredibly important department. And again, this is a department of the government that is also responsible for the 700,000 to close to a million federal workers that are organized. And we're talking about collecting union members' personal information and data and going through the financial records of a bunch of different unions, not only in the public sector, but in the private sector as well. Like, we're talking about 19 to 24-year-olds who are directly working for the richest man on the planet, basically trying to figure out whatever quote-unquote cost-cutting they can do at the Department of Labor. So it's also that situation on top of federal workers getting attacked for their union rights. So
it's not called paranoia when it's true.
Yeah, when the house, when you can smell the smoke, your house is probably on fire, unless you've left something in the onion oven for a really long time, which, you know, I think something that's also important that we've been talking about so far is that these federal workers really, really matter in the context of organized labor. We're talking about one of the largest groups of employees in this country is public sector and either regulated or unionized in the federal government. And so if we have a massive loss of this workforce, you can imagine the kind of stress that that's going to put the rest of the country under. Imagine trying to, if you make a mistake on your tax form and suddenly, you know, a significant chunk of the workforce at the IRS who's there to do that job isn't there anymore. Now, some of you might be happy about that, but frankly, if accidentally filing your taxes incorrectly are going to send you to prison, you're probably going to want to have somebody on the other end of the phone who's going to pick up and help you with that. Mm-hmm. Or, for example, you know, I mentioned infrastructure. You know, imagine the federal union workers who aren't going to be there to keep up the highways, and the highways are already in pretty bad condition as they are. So you can only imagine what repercussions are going to come out of all of this. So now the question I have to ask the table is, what do we do to help these people?
We let them know that we have their backs.
Mm-hmm.
We sign any petitions they may be circulating.
Mm-hmm.
If the crap comes down, they can't strike, but we can certainly mobilize the population in solidarity.
Absolutely.
And picket. They can't fire us. We're not their employees.
As long as we're on public property, we'll be fine.
Yeah.
I think if you organize organizations like Amazon workers, you're going to seriously damage the machine's ability to produce and supply chain. I think we need to organize workers in the critical supply areas like that.
That's actually a very good point.
Because that would stop them. I mean, that's where the free market, I mean, these capitalists are just organizing in
these
areas.
That's right? Strategic. Yeah. That's good.
Also, these government computers all use Microsoft. So maybe unionize at Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the U.S. Army one's on Windows.
Yeah.
There you go.
I imagine they're still running Excel knowing the infrastructure of the military.
Well, I think it was Vista when I was...
Yeah, there. Windows Vista.
Yeah.
That's dark.
I think this roundtable's going to get us all killed or put in prison. But.
Well, no, I think that that's actually a very important point.
I'm not scared. The
private sector is dependent on the public sector. Without the federal, you know, infrastructure, whether that's in terms of the labor force, whether that's in terms of laws and regulations around labor rights, that's dependent on what's happening to the federal workers. So it's this cascading effect of whatever happens to them. Say it with me, everybody. An injury to one is an injury to all. Gordon?
Just another point. I mentioned earlier that we had to follow every safety regulation and, you know, by the book. And we had inspectors who, that's their whole job, is to come out on the job site and see if we were complying with federal law regarding hazardous materials, hazardous waste.
Working to the rules.
But in this case, the rule was, you know, beneficial to the safety of the... A lot of people complained. They didn't want to work to the rule because it was such a pain in the neck. But what I'm getting at is that the federal workforce sets the standard for private enterprise. We had contractors who came in. They were trying to privatize the Navy. And so we had contractors come in, and some of them were pretty good outfits, but some of them cut corners. And when we found this big, long streak of gray paint going out into the bay from one of the dry docks, we busted them.
Mm-hmm.
We dropped a dime on them because they're supposed to follow the same damn rules that we have. We kept them in check. We made them comply with the safety rules because it was only fair. Come on, we have to do it. You guys have to do it. So what I'm saying is that the federal workforce and federal laws OSHA, and the like set the standard.
Speaking as somebody who has to work with hazardous waste for a living myself, I can definitely say that those inspectors and the EPA definitely come in handy to make sure that those chemicals or other related products don't accidentally get dumped or mistreated or mishandled. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if there's a spill, we have to follow certain regulations in order to make sure that that doesn't leak directly into the South Sound.
Right.
So, no, I tip my hat to that point as well.
Yeah. What are those forms? I forgot the name of the forms, but it's a whole library of forms.
MSDS.
MSDS. You mm-hmm. got it. Mm-hmm. And so we had to follow that to the letter because, come on, some of the, well, I dealt with nuclear power also. You just don't want to throw your wrench back in your toolbox when it's been in a radiation area.
When
so,
it feels warm.
Yeah, when it's a little warm, you know, you want to get it deconned.
So before the EPA was invented in the 70s, Cleveland, the Cuyahoga River had a problem.
Oh.
The river kept catching on fire because we kept dumping the waste in it. So don't be like Cleveland and catch a river on fire.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And support the federal workers who prevent that from happening. I really hate to cut the conversation short, but there is one very last brief note that I'll make. I really like what fellow worker Gordon said at the beginning of the section. And just to kind of bring it home for the listeners out there as well, the federal workers you're thinking of with the green visor and the rubber stamp in the cubicle, that's not them. It's a huge swath of all these different industries of workers who exist to make sure that things like your healthcare, your transportation, your environmental protections, your labor rights themselves are properly being maintained and regulated by the government. And regardless of whatever you think the more ideal situation of that would be, this is a huge swath of almost a million people whose rights are under attack. So what fellow worker Marilyn said, I'm going to tip my hat to her as well. If this attack continues, we need to be ready to mobilize, not only as union folks, but also as communities mm-hmm. who depend on those workers to stand up and defend them however possible. So I'm just going to leave it at that. Federal worker Gordon, you had a brief book report on that pamphlet on the history of May Day.
I'm a fellow worker now. I was a federal worker, but...
Oh, well, okay. Federal fellow worker. There we go.
Yeah, I'm going to try to keep it brief. This is a pamphlet that was brought to my attention by a couple of federal, a couple of fellow workers sitting at the table. They brought this pamphlet called History of May Day, and it was written by a guy named Alexander Trachtenberg, and he lived from 1884 to 1966, so he lived a good long life. He was born in Odessa, Russia, or it was Russia then, now it's Odessa, Ukraine. In this book, it gives a very good and brief description of why we even have a May Day. And let me just tell you, May Day is the international workers' holiday. It's celebrated all around the world except for the United States.
And Canada.
Oh, really? In Canada,
yeah.
Too? Okay, so the reason for that is that May Day is associated with left organizing, socialist, communist, and anarchist organizing. And it started out because of the plea for a shorter work day. In the 19th century, it was typical for workers to work from dawn to dusk. And I'm not kidding. Just picture working in a factory from dawn until dusk and not having any rest or any breaks or any lunchtime or anything like that. The whole movement started to get a shorter work day. And it was way back in 1806, there was a cordwainer strike. Cordwainer is a word, an antique word for a leather worker. And they were working 14, 16, 18 hours a day. So in 1837, President Van Buren declared a 10-hour day, and that was considered radical. The demand for 8 hours a day continued. Union activity in general was interrupted by the Civil War, 1861 to 1865. There were unions that had already started up. They disappeared during the Civil War. Everybody got drafted. After interrupting the labor organizing of the time, in 1866, there was an outfit called the National Labor Union, and that's when it was founded. And it concentrated. They made that 8-hour day thing their main focus. And the leader of the Molders Union, named William Silvis, kept in touch with the International, which is the first International, founded in 1864, which was the International for Socialists. This guy dies, and of course the union disappeared, National Labor Union. They adopted this demand for an 8-hour day. The militant workers of the National Labor Union and the Workers International, which was, you know, where Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, Mikhail Bakunin, and other illustrious lights from labor history were meeting at First International. We had other labor organizations start up, like the Knights of Labor, and this author, who, by the way, was a member of the American Communist Party and later the CPUSA, wrote this history to show you that from the beginning, they were organizing not only for the 8-hour day, but for 8 hours, 8 hours work, 8 hours recreation, and 8 hours rest. What happened is that in Chicago, there had been a strike at the McCormick Reaper Works, and during the strike, on May 3rd, there was a riot, and a lot of workers got, six workers got killed, and a lot of them got injured. It was just indiscriminate shooting. So on May 4th, there was a demonstration at Haymarket Square, which is down on Halsted Street, I think, in Chicago. It went on, and people were complaining about the conditions of the workers. But what happened is that somebody, an agent provocateur, it is thought, threw a bomb into the crowd. A couple of policemen got killed, and all hell broke loose after that. So, and they even rounded up four anarchists who were subsequently hanged.
And some of them were not even there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the mayor had been at that demonstration, and it was peaceful.
Yes.
So he went ahead and went home.
Yeah, a lot of people did.
But then after he went home,
that's when
this incident occurred.
The humbug.
Yeah.
And that's why it was just a setup so that, they could bust these workers. So the author stresses, Brother Trachtenberg stresses during the book that not all your labor organizations were on the side of labor. Specifically, our pals at the AFL. That was Samuel Gompers. And he began a strategy of working directly with the employers.
Knights of Labor didn't believe in striking either.
They did. They had a couple of strikes, but Knights of Labor had other flaws, which I found out.
Because Mother Jones was working with the Knights of Labor, but they weren't radical enough for her.
Right.
Well, isn't the Haymarket Square now a parking lot?
Yeah, it's a parking lot. Yeah. There's a plaque there. I've seen it.
They destroyed the square generally.
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, pave it over.
Yeah.
Same thing with the Wobbly Hall in Tacoma that you guys found out
about. Well, and so to get back to your book, you probably want to talk about why May Day is observed internationally, but not by the U.S. and Canada.
Right.
And they moved it over to Labor Day because they didn't want to encourage the leftists
and
the commies.
It was a deliberate move.
Yeah.
And now they call May Day, what do they call it, Law Day? Sure. Law Day?
Loyalty Day, I think.
Yeah, Loyalty Day. And it's show your loyalty to the to these veterans kind of thing is what I saw it with.
In other words, they screwed it all up.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, if you're interested, we'll try to get some more copies of this pamphlet. I like it because I had to figure out when it was written. Because on the inside leaf, it says, in good old anarchist tradition, it says anti-copyright. So there is no date of publication. But it's put out by Last Word Press down in Olympia, Washington. And you can get their catalog or look at what they have to offer at www.lastwordpress.com. I recommend that if you're ignorant of why we celebrate Labor Day and International Workers' Day, get a copy of this pamphlet. And it will lead you into more labor history if that's your interest. Basically, the last half of the pamphlet is testimonials from Frederick Engels, Rosa Luxemburg, from Vladimir Lenin. So if you're a fan of the history of the left or the history of labor, I highly recommend you get this pamphlet, which will lead you to other sources. And I'd like to thank our fellow workers for turn me on to it.
Can I end the with a quote from August Spies, who was hung?
Yeah, go ahead.
The time will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you strangle today.
Thank you.
Fellow worker Marilyn, would you like to do a brief environmental report?
Well, it may not be so brief. So I wanted to first of all talk about something by Rebecca Solnit, S-O-L-N-I-T. She is also the author of many books, my favorite of which is A Paradise Out of Hell, talking about what good solidarity can come out of godforsaken events.
Mm-hmm.
But she does a blog called Chop Wood, Carry Water. It's daily action, and it's at substack.com. I love this because it's all good news of what is going right. But I'm going to go ahead anyhow. So after being sued by the ACLU, the Border Patrol said it will retrain hundreds of California agents on how to comply with the Constitution. And I'm not going to read all of these because there's so many. It just talks about more people officially disapprove of Trump. and the deportations than approve of him. So he's tanking. We know that Musk's Tesla organization is tanking. And I'm not going to take time that we don't really have, because I could go on and on, but I really want to suggest to the listener that they go on Chop Wood, Carry Water by Rebecca Solnit, S-O-L-N-I-T, at Substack.com. And the other thing I wanted to talk about, some of you may have heard about an organization known as the Backbone Campaign. And it started a number of years ago out of Vashon Island by a man whose name is Bill Moyer. Not the Bill Moyer, a different Bill Moyer, but he's an amazing human being. One of the things he's gotten involved in, well, first of all, Backbone Campaign was started to try to put the spine back in the Democratic Party.
Good luck.
I know. Well, what he's gotten involved in lately is something called Solutionary Rail. And I have been listening to some amazing podcasts. I have the book, and if anybody at the table wants to read it, you're welcome to. But he started a podcast, and it's called Reconnect America, podcast and blog. What he's gotten involved in is how the railroads could not only reduce political polarization and how they could facilitate a renewable energy revolution. When the railroads were first given the right-of-way to take land to get across the country and to move goods.
Well, whether they were or not given permission, they still do it.
The way it worked is private tycoons funded the building of those railroads.
Credit Mobilier.
Pardon?
Credit Mobilier was a conglomerate of capitalists.
Fast forward, we have a functioning rail system that was picking up goods in little tiny farm towns and transporting them to the hubs where they could be distributed. We had a rail line that took passengers all over the country. People would take the train from Newark to Washington, D.C., from little tiny towns that it stopped in. That was a common way for people to travel, and it was cost effective. Then, fast forward to Eisenhower and the love of the cars and the open road and the rebuilding of the highways and the tax, U.S. tax money going to build airports when the planes were developed. So the U.S. government was funding the roads, the highways, and the airports, but they weren't funding the railroads. That had always been private.
I would say that the workers actually were, the public sector was doing it. Us, we were doing all that. Roads, you know, the airports, even the internet. Not necessarily the government,
right,
but the workers created it, I would say.
Well,
and the private companies got the benefit from it.
Right. Now, there was the Interstate Commerce Law that was, I forget what year, was enacted. And that was supposed to keep competition fair. But of course, the oligarchs found ways to get around that. So what we have now is rail systems where they're trying to get the maximum profit. And the maximum profit, if they can get 50 cents on the dollar instead of 10 cents on the dollar, why should they do 10 cents on the dollar? If passengers aren't as profitable, if stopping in small farm towns is not as profitable, why should they stop? So that's why you have these giant rail lines that merge, Burlington Northern, Santa Fe, and all of the other ones, that no longer stop at the small towns. They no longer provide the passenger service. Farmers can't even get their stuff to market unless they drive it because the trains aren't stopping there. But we have this system now that if it were electrified, which is entirely possible, would not only reduce pollution, it would help get trucks and cars off the road. It would help farmers get their things to market. It's a wonderful idea. So this podcast that he does and the book that he's written is well worth reading because there are already some tiny improvements. Obviously, he's fighting a huge system. Obviously, we know that the railroad workers are in trouble because the rail lines, in their squeeze for the bucks, mm-hmm. are reducing staff. It's become a dangerous situation. So on behalf of the workers, on behalf of the writers, on behalf of the producers of our foods and our goods, this is something that would be well worth listening to. Now, he's gotten the idea out. I think it was Louisiana. A Republican governor there started listening to this and was actually able to explain to the government and to the citizens that if they brought back small town passenger rail, that they would actually get so much money in increased tourism that the system would pay for itself, the cost of repairing the rail lines and things. So they actually put in short lines in Louisiana. That's one success. And there is a short line here in Washington, in eastern Washington, that they've been working on. This is really interesting stuff. So the name of the podcast is Reconnect America. The name of the book is Solutionary Rail. The name of the author is Bill Moyer, just like it sounds. And I highly recommend this. That's all I'm going to say.
In that case, why don't we go ahead and close out our show with some local events previous and upcoming. Would anyone like to give just a brief report on May Day showing up here in Tacoma?
Everybody loved it. It was a huge hit.
Yes, some of our IWW members got to play Solidarity Forever as everybody started gathering up for the march down to the Northwest Detention Center. I led that off, and that was very fun, even though I'm pretty nervous in front of a microphone.
I heard you, and I saw you.
So thank you. Yeah, I know you two were doing car escort work for the parade, correct?
Well, we were doing car security and escort.
And thank you so much for doing
but
that.
But it was a peaceful demonstration. There were no incidences of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody brought a bubble-making machine.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very festive event. Somebody told me that they thought in a way that it was like a music festival. Not that there was that much music, but it was that kind of solidarity and joy of people coming together.
And just the energy of it.
Yeah. So at one end, at Tollefson Plaza, were a lot of union members and CAS members, that's Climate Alliance of the South Sound, talking about May Day and the need to unionize. Mm. And at the other end, that was sponsored by La Resistencia and other immigration advocacy groups, including Filipino. I think it was a huge success. They estimate about 1,500 people. And I was pretty tired, even though I didn't march.
Oh, I walked the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I had to be down there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
So the post-protest euphoria is amazing. If you've never been to a protest, go to a protest. The post-protest euphoria is always good. I love it. I love that feeling after a protest.
There was a celebration at Seven Seas, and I didn't know about it. I came back home, and it was a huge party. Next time, I'll know.
There's also going to be a union movie night through the Tacoma Labor School here, and it's going to be at Common Good Tacoma. That's 621...
Tacoma Avenue.
621 Tacoma Avenue. Thank you.
Downstairs and back.
Yep. And the movie they're going to be showing is Union Time, which is a documentary and following up with a conversation with all the attendants. That's going to be on May 9th at 7 p.m. And Union Time is the story of a union campaign. And it's also going to be, a discussion after the showing of the movie. Is there any other announcements? One brief shout-out I'd like to give is to our fellow worker in the Tacoma branch, fellow worker Alan. He's been dealing with some health-related issues lately, and we've really been missing him in the union and at the radio showings.
But he's out of the hospital. He's in good spirits.
Yay. And once again, this is a production of the Tacoma Industrial Workers of the World, a union for all industries. If you'd like to get in touch with us, feel free to reach out to our Facebook page or our Instagram page, or you can email us directly at tacoma@iww.org to get in touch with an organizer today. We want to thank all of our radio broadcasters as well. 101.9 KTAH, 95.3 KTQA, and our broadcaster up in Bellingham, 94.9 KZAX. Thank you for tuning in, and solidarity.
Solidarity.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM, KTAH. Solidarity.